From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Margaret Drabble's early novels predated the contemporary feminist movement. She made a name for herself writing introspective, autobiographical novels about the family and career choices women face. On this edition of Fresh Air, Margaret Drabble tells us why she decided to stop writing that kind of novel. Also, John Malpede and Kevin Williams tell us about bringing the homeless to the stage through their performance group, the LAPD, that stands for the Los Angeles Poverty Department. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from saxophonist Billy Pierce. And TV critic David Bianculli previews ABC's docudrama based on the Challenger disaster. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney is touring Eastern Asia to discuss scaling down U.S. forces. But during a stop in the Philippines today, he ended up promising to try to restore $100 million in aid to that country. Pat Ford reports from Manila.
The U.S. agreed to pay the Philippines nearly $500 million a year as compensation for Clark Air Base and Subic Naval Base. But Congress cut this year's appropriation in an effort to trim the budget deficit. The issue has touched off a wave of anti-American and anti-basis sentiment, and Cheney is bearing the brunt of it. President Aquino refused to meet with him. 110 of 195 Philippine congressmen urged Aquino to suspend talks on the future of the bases until the aid is restored, and protesters marched to the U.S. Embassy today, chanting, "Cheney, go home," and "Bases out." After meeting with Philippine Defense Secretary Fidel Ramos, Cheney said he would do his best to meet the full commitment, but he didn't sound hopeful. For National Public Radio, this is Pat Ford in Manila.
Israel raided Palestinian bases near the port of Sidon today, saying the bases were used to organize attacks on Israeli troops. Lebanese police say one person was killed and three wounded in two air raids. Police say that in the first assault, four Israeli fighter bombers fired 8 rockets at the installations. 30 minutes later, a police spokesman says another formation hit the bases as the guerrillas tried to evacuate their casualties. The raids bring to 6 the number of Israeli airstrikes against guerrilla targets in Lebanon this year. The situation remained tense in Romania's capital, Bucharest, following yesterday's violent anti-government demonstrations. Further uncertainty is being caused by new reports that thousands of coal miners intent on showing their support for the government have arrived in the capital. From Bucharest, the BBC's Alex Brody reports.
The coal miners from the Jiu Valley told reporters that they were coming to Bucharest to support the government in response to yesterday's attack on government headquarters. In a speech on national radio, President Iliescu told them not to come. Tonight, army protection of the offices of opposition parties has been stepped up. President Iliescu said the country needed more guarantee of stability. Otherwise, he said, we risk a new Lebanon here. And he addressed more forthrightly than before the continued role of members of Ceausescu's security police. President Iliescu spoke of the need for a purge of the guilty ones. In his speech on national radio, he urged the country to rally round the present leadership to ensure quiet and stability so the work of remedying the legacy of the old regime could be done.
The BBC's Alex Brody in Bucharest. Nelson Mandela appealed directly to Britain today to press for continued sanctions against South Africa until there is a final victory against apartheid. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher suggested last week lifting some sanctions. This is NPR News. Striking Pittston Coal Company miners in 3 states are voting on a new contract. The Compromise Pact, which affects miners in West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky, is expected to be approved. The polls close tonight, and the results are expected to be announced tomorrow from a district union office in Castlewood, Virginia. The 10-month-old walkout has been bitter and sometimes violent. Václav Havel, the dissident playwright who became the president of Czechoslovakia, arrived in Washington this evening for talks with President Bush and meetings with administration officials. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Havel will meet with the president at the White House tomorrow. Havel says he is not coming hat in hand looking for charity, but rather to encourage investment in Czechoslovakia and to inaugurate a new relationship of friendship between the U.S. and his country. On Wednesday, Havel will address a joint session of Congress, and then he will travel to New York for meetings with business, political, and cultural leaders. He will also attend a rock concert in his honor before returning to Prague. Havel spent 5 years in Czech prisons, and his plays were banned for nearly 20 years because of his outspoken views on human rights and democracy. When the communist government of Gustav Husák resigned in the face of massive protests last year, Havel became the head of the caretaker government. In June, Czechoslovakia will hold its first free parliamentary elections in more than 40 years. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Bulgaria's reformist leaders have given private farmers more freedom and are considering selling some shops and restaurants to private owners to revitalize the stagnant economy. The official news agency said a government decree gives private farmers the rights to decide their own production methods and export their produce. It sets no limits on the amount of land they can farm. The government also agreed to set up a bank offering loans to finance the building of small farms and food processing enterprises. The official Iranian news agency says Iran has hanged 30 people convicted of drug trafficking. I'm Doreen McAllister, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Margaret Drabble is one of the most respected novelists in her native England. She was one of the first women novelists to write about the dilemmas of career and family faced by contemporary women. As Canadian novelist Margaret Atwood put it, Drabble was one of the first writers to take women's domestic life, the diapers, the dishes, the rashes, and treat it as literature suitable for fiction. Drabble has written 11 novels since 1963, including The Garrick Year, The Needle's Eye, The Ice Age, and The Middle Ground. She spent the first half of the 1980s editing the Oxford Companion to English Literature, and then she returned to fiction. The two books she's written since, The Radiant Way and A Natural Curiosity, are about the same characters, three middle-aged professional women living in contemporary England. I asked Margaret Drabble if she's been trying new things and writing in a new voice since her return to fiction.
Yes, I think I have. One of the reasons for the gap was that I was rather tired with what I had been doing. I thought I'd come to the end of a particular vein, and I wanted to write a different kind of book. I wasn't sure whether I was able to, but I wanted to have a go.
What kinds of differences were you looking for?
Well, I wanted to write a less interior, more exterior book. I wanted to write a book that jumped around a lot. I was tired of looking deep into the psyches of characters, and I was tired of the introspective novel, I suppose. And I was also tired of the domestic novel. The novel that I published in 1980, The Middle Ground, is a very domestic novel, although it reaches out from its domestic centre. And I wanted to write a book that was simply more mobile.
Why were you tired of writing in such an introspective voice?
I think because I'd done all the introspection I needed to do. I'd sort of solved all the problems. And there was nothing more in there that I wanted to say. I was much more interested, which I think is very common at my age, in what was going on around me than in worrying and angst about my own life and problems.
So, A Natural Curiosity, it strikes me, for instance, is more about the evil side of human nature, in a way. Why that exists? What are we to make of it? Can we change it? Is there a way of getting around it?
Yes, it's a more abstract question, and it comes up in the book in many forms, some of them sort of fairly black comic forms. But it's not an interior book. It's asking a question about the whole of human nature, if you like.
Well, one of your characters, a woman, visits a serial murderer repeatedly, and this murderer killed one of her students. Can you explain her preoccupation with trying to understand him?
Well, yes. I mean, it seems to me a very natural curiosity, which is why I gave the book its title, because I find it very hard, as Alex Bowen in the novel finds it hard, to believe that people enjoy murdering people, and that I also find it hard to believe that psychotic characters are evil. I think it's much more likely that something went wrong with a connection somewhere in childhood. And Alex, of course, during the novel, is interested, indeed sort of obsessed with proving that this is the case, that he didn't commit the murders out of evil. Because when you see him, he, like many serial murderers, is a mild, quiet-looking young man who looks as though he wouldn't hurt a fly. So she's interested in the enigma of this kind of personality.
I think the other side is taken by a character named Brian, who thinks that you know, Terry Waite really shouldn't have tried to free the hostages. He says, why can't people accept the limitations of the human condition instead of trying to show off all the time?
That's quite right. Absolutely. And I think these are two contrasting positions. I think it's also fair to say that Alex wasn't trying to show off. I mean, she does her prison visiting quite modestly and secretly. She doesn't go around saying that she is a martyr.
What about just accepting the limitations of the human condition?
I don't think that's possible.
You don't think it's possible?
No, I don't. I think that Brian would like to think it's possible, but it's not. One has to keep looking.
Mm-hmm.
One has to keep looking for explanations. That's why we're here, or one of the reasons why we're here. It's certainly one of the reasons why I think I'm here, is to ask questions for which there are no answers.
Novelist Margaret Drabble is my guest. Her new book is called A Natural Curiosity. You know, getting back to the 7-year hiatus that you took from fiction, I found myself looking to The Middle Ground, your novel right before the hiatus, for some clues to why you stopped writing fiction for a while. And I'd like to just read one paragraph from that novel. And this paragraph describes some of the reasons why a woman who's a journalist feels she's suddenly facing both a midlife crisis and professional restlessness. The area which she had made her own seemed ever more confining. What had seemed unexplored terrain became well-trodden as more and more women began to write about menstruation, battered wives, low career expectations for girls. In short, as the women's movement gathered momentum, she found herself trapped in stale repetition and depressed by the fact that as everyone else got more interested in women, she became less and less so. The feeling of deep boredom which overcame her when she opened a woman's novel frightened her.
Yes.
Did that describe how you were feeling at the time?
Well, I mean, that's a parody of how I was feeling. But, yes, obviously some of that feeling I recognise very much, that what had seemed fresh and interesting is becomes familiar. And when everybody's doing it, you're glad they're doing it. You're glad that these topics are sort of constantly presented for public discussion, but you don't want to go on doing it yourself. You yourself feel you've done that bit. It's time to move on. And I think this is a very normal feeling. Also, I'd like to point out that the character in the novel, Kate, is a journalist with a weekly column. So every week she has to find a subject to bang on about. And she's finding this a bit tedious. I think it's probably more difficult to write a weekly column than to write a novel.
But with you now, you had written about women's lives in your novels, and the territory you wrote was being covered by other women as you get older. Now, you published your first novel in 62 or 63.
Yeah.
But did you start feeling like the territory was becoming more confining with the arrival of more women novelists, more serious women novelists?
I suppose I felt that the territory was becoming overtrodden. And that particular kind of novel I no longer wanted to write. Other people were writing it. I had written mine, and mine were there on the shelf. I mean, I haven't unwritten them. They still stand there, and they probably speak to women in their 30s as they did when I was in my 30s. In fact, I know they do because people tell me so. But I knew that for me there was something else that I ought to be doing. It's as though you hand on the torch. That sounds a bit grandiose and pompous, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, your character in The Middle Ground expresses not only her boredom with women's novels, but her horror at the commercialization of the feminist novel. Were you finding that too, the commercialization of the feminist novel?
Well, yes, I mean, I do find this disturbing. I find the whole idea of being a professional feminist rather worrying. And there's something in the publishing industry and the media, as soon as they discover something, you know, it's women's novels or it's the Latin American novel or it's magic realism, and I find that uncomfortable. I don't want to pander to a kind of trivialization and commercialization of something that I take very seriously. I don't like the idea that I, as a woman novelist, should support all other women novelists, regardless of whether I think they're any good or not. And that is certainly a feeling you get in some parts of the so-called feminist movement.
Were these sentiments ever uncomfortable for you to admit to?
No, not at all. I'm delighted to admit to them.
Mm-hmm.
Other people don't like them, but I don't feel ashamed of them at all. I think they should feel ashamed of themselves, myself.
Although you have been an important writer for many feminist readers and writers, I'm wondering if you identified with the feminist movement. You started writing in the early 60s, and you had started to establish yourself before the renaissance of the feminist movement in the late 60s.
That's right. I predate it, and some of my books were its raw material. and I have been processed, and sometimes I'm not entirely happy with the processing. I mean, I can process my own work.
What do you mean you've been processed?
Well, people have interpreted my work in ways and presented it to the public in ways that I don't necessarily agree with. I mean, people are at liberty to do this, of course, that's fine, but I'm at liberty to say that's not quite what I meant, and anyway, I'm now off to do something else, thank you very much.
Are you saying that you haven't seen your novels as feminist novels?
Oh, not at all. I don't think I'm the same kind of feminist that the feminists are who are picking up my points. I think there are many versions of feminism. I think that life is an extremely complex business, and that one of the points of writing novels is to show that it is complicated, and that if you write a scene in which a woman asks her husband to start the car on a frosty morning because she can't get it going, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. If you write a scene in which a woman is a bad cook, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. If you write a scene in which a woman is a good cook, you haven't betrayed the women's movement. It's the simplification of feminist criticism which sometimes irritates me, and I try to get my characters to edge pretty quickly out of the pigeonholes that people are trying to put them into. Because to me, the confusion, the muddle, the struggling between ideology and reality is what makes a novel and life real and interesting.
I've read that your mother was a feminist, and I was wondering in what respect.
She was a feminist in that she read Bernard Shaw and The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, and she believed that women should be educated, and she thought it was disgraceful to spend more on educating your sons than your daughters. And she would have liked a career had society permitted her to have one. She was a teacher, but when she married, as happened in those days, she had to leave her job. When the war broke out and the men were called up, she went back to her job as a teacher. When the war ended, she was dismissed again. And this made her rather a vocal feminist at times. But she wasn't a very effective one because society didn't permit her to be so. And also she became very embittered. I think that hatred and embitteredness, if that's a word, are dangerous for people. They make them very unhappy and they make them ineffective at the same time.
But since she was fighting for rights for women, you know, personally, did you grow up just taking that for granted that women should be equal and that women could work?
Well, life is never as simple as that. I mean, we grew up taking it for granted that women were intellectually equal. There was no suggestion in our household that they weren't, and it would have been inappropriate if they had been, because we were clever girls, you know, we were scholarship girls. It was obvious that we were equal intellectually. But when it actually came to the job market and to having careers, of course it became much, much more opaque and confused, as my mother's life had been. She wanted us, I think, to marry and have babies. She didn't want us to do it as soon as we did. We married and had babies to get away from her. And life is not, you know, not clear. And looking back, one looks back again and again, as my character Liz Headland looks back in a natural curiosity for the skeletons in your family cupboard. And although I can honestly say that my mother was a feminist, I can also honestly say that she probably wasn't a very good influence in some respects.
Like what?
The image she gave of domestic life was negative. She didn't like other people. She was, as I said, embittered and never saw that she herself could take those steps that would alter her life. She never took them. She prided herself on her domestic life, which she made into a sort of prison for herself, which was contradictory to her theory, but is in practice what she did.
I'm surprised that your reaction wasn't to see domestic life as a prison and avoid it yourself, instead of having babies at such a young age.
Well, I did both. I mean, I both had babies at a young age, and I saw what I was doing as a prison, and then I got out of it. I mean, I think what had happened was that my generation of women in the late 50s and early 60s, we'd been told by our mothers, many of whom were emancipated, I mean, there was emancipation before the 1960s, that we should go to college, that we could have jobs, and also we could be fulfilled women and we could have babies too. I mean, the sort of spinster profession of the 1930s was no longer the model for us. We were going to do everything. And we tried to do everything, and then we realised that doing everything was exhausting. And out of this sense of exhaustion and conflict and competition with ourselves rose the woman's novel, then rose feminist literary theory and the women's movement itself, out of this ideal that we couldn't realise.
I want to talk with you more, but first we're going to take a short break. The British novelist Margaret Drabble is my guest, and her new novel is called A Natural Curiosity. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Margaret Drabble is my guest. You started out in theater before you wrote, and one of the things that's always mentioned about your early theater days is that you understudied Vanessa Redgrave in a production of Cymbeline.
That's right.
How serious were you about acting, and what were your insecurities, if you had any, about that profession?
I was very serious about being an actress, and I think if I hadn't had children so quickly, I would be an actress now, in that I think I could have earned my living. I wasn't a very varied actress. I was rather a heavyweight, but I certainly was being offered work. But then with children it became increasingly difficult and increasingly unattractive, and I began to see that this wasn't going to work, really. Acting as a profession is a very unsatisfactory way of life. It's an unsatisfactory lifestyle. And I began to see there were ways where I could have more control over what I was doing.
How did you start writing?
Well, I wrote my first novel while I was still an actress. And I wrote it in the evenings. I wasn't acting at the time. My first husband was at the Royal Shakespeare Company at Stratford, and I was pregnant, expecting my first baby, and I wrote my first novel in the evenings then. And I did it really just to give myself something to do.
When you were in your 20s, a young mother, did you think of yourself as writing about women in a way that women hadn't much written about before in fiction?
I don't think I was conscious of it. I just wrote about what was there. And it was only when the books were published and people began to tell me what they were about that I realised that perhaps there wasn't all that much written about this particular social phenomenon, the young graduate mother. I remember I went to Paris on a travel grant in 1966, when I had three young children, and I took the three young children with me, of course. I mean, that's what I did. And I remember my publishers, my French publishers and my English publishers, sort of saying, who did I want to meet in Paris? And I said, well, I'd like to meet young women writers of about my own age. And there weren't any. There just weren't any. I mean, the woman's novel hadn't been invented in France. There was a long hiatus. And there just weren't any people like me. Whereas in England, there were beginning to be people like me.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, we were talking earlier about how you felt that the feminist novel had become commercialized, and that the subjects you had been exploring were already being explored by so many people once, I guess, we had the 1970s. Was your initial feeling when more women started writing fiction, when there were more feminist novels, one of companionship, of being glad to be able to share the field with other women?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it was very exciting to find that, and there were other people doing it. And I still feel that. I mean, some of my best friends are women novelists.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to differentiate between those who are jumping on the bandwagon and those who are doing it for real. And I think there is a distinction. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not going to name the names of those who I think jump on the bandwagon, but I could list a long list of women writers, starting with Doris Lessing and coming down to Mary Gordon, who I think are writing wonderful fiction.
Mm-hmm. Let's move up ahead in time a little bit. While you were taking your hiatus from fiction and writing, editing the Oxford Companion to Literature, did you find it a relief to be writing nonfiction and to be writing short biography?
Yes, I did. I thought it was a relief to be doing something constructive, by which I mean that at the end of every day I'd covered more paper and I'd put another little piece into the jigsaw. I'd done another letter of the alphabet. Well, actually, that's not true, because a letter of the alphabet would take me about 9 months. But I did actually feel I'd moved along a bit. And that was very satisfying. I mean, part of me has always rather liked filing systems and sorting things out and making columns and writing out vocabularies. And this part hadn't been used very much lately. So it was good fun having a go at something totally different. It was also quite sociable, which writing novels isn't. In fact, it was too sociable. I had a full-time assistant kind of living in my house because I worked at home, and she and I had lunch together every day for 5 years. But that was quite fun, being in an office situation in my own house and corresponding with people and sort of having lunches with people and, pestering everybody I knew about what to do next with the Oxford Companion, which I would never do with a novel.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to write your own entry?
I didn't have an entry.
Why not?
I didn't put myself in because I thought if I put myself in, everybody would complain and say, who does she think she is? And if I left myself out, everybody would say, why has she left herself out? Which is much pleasanter for me.
But now you won't be in it until there's another edition.
Well, my assistant is actually, at the moment, I trust, compiling a 20th century companion. I said I didn't want any truck with this because it would bring me into too dangerous territory. But that will give her an opportunity to put in a lot of younger writers who were ineligible for our volume and also people like me who were on the borderline.
Mm-hmm. You are married now to the biographer Michael Holroyd, who just completed the second volume in a 3-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw, and he was, in fact, a guest on our program. And I had asked him about this, and I'd like to ask you as well, and that's about your living relationship. You live nearby but in separate houses from each other. I find that just a very interesting arrangement, and I really understand the, drive for privacy, which is what I suppose is behind that arrangement. But I guess what I'd like to ask you is why get married if you're going to live separately?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I don't know if I can give you a very satisfactory answer. Did you ask Michael this?
Not in those words exactly, because I think it wasn't until after the interview that I realized that was really what my question was.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. I mean, the lifestyle is absolutely fine and obviously pleasant, and a lot of people would like to do it if they had 2 houses or could afford to do it. But, I mean, particularly if they married kind of later in life, as we did. But why we got married is a sort of mystery to me. I think it's something to do with the fact that Michael and I, we'd been going out together and sort of taking one another out for meals for quite a long time. But Michael and I are both very polite people and rather reserved and private people in a strange way. That's something we have very much in common. And we were so polite that we couldn't quite work out what the other person wanted all the time. And I think we thought if we got married, it would be a shortcut through a lot of that. It would be easier to cut through all that and just know that we were a couple, even if we didn't seem to be a couple or look like a couple, that on one level we were a couple and we could rely on each other in a particular kind of way. It also made it very convenient with going on lecture tours for the British Council because we could travel together. And although I missed him this time in America, quite often we do get to travel together. And it's very nice to travel together as husband and wife and be and feel that, we are accepted as a couple without people worrying about whether we're a couple or not.
Okay. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Margaret Drabble's latest novel is A Natural Curiosity. It continues the story of the characters introduced in her previous book, The Radiant Way. Drabble's earlier novels include The Needle's Eye and The Ice Age. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, one of the leading figures in nonprofit theater in the U.S., Robert Brustein. He founded the Yale Repertory Theater and the American Repertory Theater at Harvard, which he still directs. He's also the theater critic for the New Republic. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1985, performance artist John Malpied began holding free workshops and talent shows in the Skid Row parks and shelters of Los Angeles. Those early experiments led to the LAPD, the Los Angeles Poverty Department. It's a theater group featuring homeless performers. The assistant director, Kevin Williams, used to be homeless. Coming up, Malpied and Williams tell us about giving a stage and a voice to those without a home. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the album we're listening to now by saxophonist Billy Pierce. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Challenger, ABC's docudrama, tracing the events that led to the 1986 space shuttle disaster. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In East Germany today, the Roundtable recommended slashing that country's extensive food subsidy system even before the March elections. Deidre Berger reports from West Berlin.
Both government and opposition groups agreed during today's Roundtable session that food subsidies have to be stopped. The East Berlin government spends more than $15 billion a year to keep prices on basics like bread and milk artificially low. The roundtable members agreed that dismantling of state subsidies is necessary to prepare the country for a currency union with West Germany. To ease the impact, the roundtable recommended the government give each East German an extra $80 per month to counteract the higher food prices. Tomorrow, East and West German officials will meet in Berlin for the first time to start working out details of the currency union. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in West Berlin.
East German Prime Minister Hans Modrow said today that his meeting last week with West German Chancellor Kohl has made it possible for speedy unification of the two Germanies. But the Prime Minister also warned that fears and concern in other countries, including France, Poland, and the Soviet Union, must be considered. Once again in Leipzig, there's been a big demonstration, as some 40,000 people Monday night called for the swift unification of Germany. A declaration by Israeli Foreign Minister Ahrens, which appears to support German unification, has been given considerable media play in both East and West Germany. In Israel, though, that statement has been sharply criticized by members of his own Likud party. Patricia Golan has more on the story.
Last week, on the eve of a state visit to West Germany, Foreign Minister Ahrens told a group of Canadian Jews that there is no real danger in a reunified Germany if it is a democratic country and is fully conscious of the responsibility it has to the Jewish people. It was a message Ahrens repeated in cables to Israeli embassies around the world, even though Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir only recently expressed grave reservations over the prospects of a reunited Germany. Several of Ahrens' own Likud party colleagues in the cabinet have expressed outrage at Ahrens' remarks. Environment Minister Roni Milo insists that Israel take a stern position on the issue in light, he said, of the Jews' terrible experience with Germany. Ahrens, whose own parents died in the Holocaust, denies he supports German reunification. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
And for the first time in over 40 years, people living in Hungary are now able to buy lottery tickets in Austria, and sales have been brisk. The tickets, priced at about 50 cents each, give buyers a chance at jackpots in the Austrian lottery, which is tied to an international network. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Tenor and soprano saxophonist Billy Pierce first made a name for himself as part of drummer Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers in the early 80s. And more recently, he's been part of drummer Tony Williams' quintet. On his new CD, Pierce has teamed up with a couple of veteran musicians to play some jazz standards. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it sounds a little bit different from the usual modern bop date.
Billy Pierce breaks out of the same old bebop rut on his new album, not by adding a little something extra, but by taking something away. His band is just saxophone, piano, and drums. There's no bass player. this particular trio format is unusual, but not unprecedented. Tenor saxophonist Bud Freeman had a group like it in 1938, and Lester Young led an excellent trio in 1945 with Nat King Cole on piano and Buddy Rich on drums. In 1962, pianist Cecil Taylor put together a very different trio with saxophonist Jimmy Lyons and drummer Sonny Murray. There have been a few other sax, piano, and drum trios, too. Obviously, there's a lot of room for diversity within that seemingly limited format. The thing I find most interesting about such trios is what the players do, or don't do, to compensate for the absence of a bass. On Billy Pierce's new album, which is called Equilateral on the Sunnyside label, the musicians sometimes play the same way they would if there were a bass. Here's their take on Sonny Stitt's bebop line, The Eternal Triangle. Pierce's rhythm players usually alter their approaches to fill the vacuum. His comrades are two distinguished veterans, pianist Hank Jones and drummer Roy Haynes. Both are closely associated with modern bebop, but in this setting, their playing tends to be more conservative than usual. The drummer marks off the beat more explicitly than he might with a bass player along, and the pianist fills in bass runs with his left hand. Those are tactics bebop musicians got away from almost 50 years ago. Reintroducing them gives this session a pleasantly archaic tinge. On Harold Arlen's Come Rain or Come Shine, Hank Jones edges towards Fats Waller-style stride piano. On Arthur Schwartz's tune, Alone Together, the trio mixes periods even more dramatically. Pianist Hank Jones again slides in and out of old-timey left-hand bass lines, and Roy Haynes raps out a steady shuffle rhythm with his brushes. But Pierce's soprano sax shows the influence of modernist John Coltrane. remarkable thing about this music is that it doesn't sound contrived or incongruous. At a time when musicians are often accused of being too eclectic or backward-looking, this trio retraces aspects of jazz history in a fresh and unpretentious way.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the new CD, Equilateral, by Billy Pierce on the Sunnyside label. This is Fresh Air. There's a theater group based in L.A.'s Skid Row called the LAPD, short for the Los Angeles Poverty Department. Most of the LAPD's performers are homeless or live in Skid Row hotels. The group was founded in 1985 by John Malpied, a former New York performance artist who was bored with the insularity of the downtown art scene and was looking for something more meaningful. He moved to Los Angeles, became a legal advocate for the homeless, and then combined his advocacy work with theater. The group occasionally travels to other cities to take up residencies. Once there, the LAPD recruits local players from shelters, welfare offices, and the streets. New material is developed from their stories of life on the streets. I spoke with Malpied when the LAPD performed in Philadelphia last fall. We were joined by the group's assistant director, Kevin Williams, who was formerly homeless. I asked Malpied to give us a sense of how the shows are created.
When we first started the group, everyone, because most of the people down there have had very little attention given them, you know, starting in childhood, really, you know.
Or negative attention.
Yeah, or negative attention, like they were the brunt, the family goat or whatever. You know, everyone was dying for attention. So when the group first started, everyone brought in their own manuscript and stood up and read it at the same time, you know. And everyone wanted to be the star, and everyone wanted their show to be done. You know, well, I really wasn't interested in this in the first place, you know, and so because it was really an impossible situation, we started working without scripts, and so that everybody could contribute, but no one would have authorship, and it also maintains the chaos and the jarringness of life on Skid Row. So it turns out to be a really appropriate style for the group.
Give us a really short capsule description of one of the plays you've recently done.
Jupiter 35 is about one of the group's members, Leroy Mills, who was tossed from a sixth-floor window of a Los Angeles building and survived. And the group's participation in his reemergence into society.
He was robbed and thrown from a sixth-floor window, which is a common way of dealing with people on Skid Row, because it's cheap, you don't have to buy bullets or anything like that, and of course it's a suicide, you know. So, but anyway, he survived, and his face is completely restructured, and it's about his recuperation, and about the events that led up to his being tossed out the window, yeah. And then also about the group's relationship to him, because some of us played ourselves visiting him in the hospital and things like that.
You must get quite a mix of people coming down to, like, first performances or auditions or whatever they are in the beginning. And I'd imagine that some of the people are people who are really, like, interested in the chance to perform, people who are homeless because they're down on their luck or because they're a victim of unemployment or whatever. But I bet you also get a lot of people who are, hardened criminals, or who are, you know, kind of psychopathic and you know, kind of nuts. I'm sure some people come down hoping that they can rip you off or something while they're there.
Yeah, well, we teach them a lesson I have a big monologue where I admit that, yes, I am the biggest chump in America. And this is a... and that, yes, I have bought more crack cocaine than anyone in America without knowing it.
without having
only,
any.
You know, only because I thought I was giving people money for a sandwich and all this other stuff. You know, so at one point, because when we were in San Francisco a couple of years, what you're describing happened. And we went from having about 15 people the first day until we had one person actually in the show, and everyone else was running scams. And so the way we took out our vengeance is by including all this in the show. And so I have this big monologue about that.
Well, what did you do at the time, though, when you realized you were being scammed? Could you get rid of the people?
Well, usually they disappear. Around. After the scam, they usually disappear.
Yeah.
Well, they think they've played their string out as far as possible.
Or if we let them know that we're onto it.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah.
Right. But the one thing, when I started the group, it seemed to be really important that it be a very open door policy. Because what I'd seen on Skid Row, and of course I was full of naivete at the time, was that a lot of the people who are the most in need of services aren't going to get them because it's always you can have a bed if you behave yourself. You can have a meal if you behave yourself. Well, these people, they aren't going to act right. Therefore, the people that aren't going to act right are going to be out on the street. So I was interested in including those people as much as possible and seeing what made them tick and having them be part of the group. But, and we do have a lot of people, we've had a lot of people with mental problems in the group, and we still do. I mean, probably half of the people in the group are now getting SSI, which is the federal benefit for people who can't work for mental or physical reasons. In our cases, people in our group, it's for mental disabilities for the most part. But a lot of them have been enormous contributors to the group and have done really, really, really great work. So, having problems isn't a criteria for getting booted, nor is having talent a criteria for being included. I mean, yeah.
I was watching you work with some people from Philadelphia yesterday, and these were people who, I think there were like three homeless people from Philadelphia who'd come down to work with you during the time I was there. One of them was sleeping across three chairs in the theater part, and Kevin, what you did was to wake him up, stick him with a pin.
Well, yeah, I did. Didn't actually stick him, I threatened to. I let him see I had it.
What kind of response were you looking for?
Guess what, Junior? It doesn't play here. There's a social agencies. the first day we were here when we did our workshop and we were doing the welfare thing, we came to this point in the middle of two people's improv where the improv broke apart and the entire room joined in because everyone felt like, if you go into a welfare place, you go into a social agency, and if you tell them the truth, you won't get any help. But if you lie, and if you're just willing to sit around and bum around, you get, the services, whatever services you need or want, or they'll give you. And in our group, it's like, no, it doesn't, we don't want you to lie to us and go to sleep and just sit around. We want involvement. We want involvement. And get in your face involvement, or get out.
You've, I'm sure, been to several Skid Rows and gang areas and cities across the country because, first of all, because you've traveled, and second of all, because you've traveled with the group and you go there to recruit people to perform with you. Are you struck more by the similarities or differences from city to city?
I'm beginning to be able to see some differences. The most interesting difference that I'm feeling now is the guys, the attitude of the guys we're working with. Like when we were in San Francisco, I was saying earlier, we had run into a lot of scams up in San Francisco. And San Francisco is a city, that is super socially conscious. And they have like program after program after program after program for homeless people and for all kinds of people. It's just a very involved community. But when we were there, when this happened 2 years ago, these guys who were like really, they were in shelters. They were getting three squares at Glide Memorial Church and all this.
Vultures.
But they were still, they had this attitude like, who can we scam for nothing?
What can now, the you guys, do for me?
The guys we're working with here, most of them are sleeping on the street because they don't like the city shelter system, which is, really pretty bad, and dangerous and ugly and so forth. They're sleeping on the street, and They're not really connected to anything, or up until they got involved with us. But yet they were looking. They really, They have no one's asked me, tried to hit any of us up for money or run any sort of scams on us whatsoever. They're interested in just
the work.
Doing this because they feel that it's going to help them, that it's fun to be with us, you know, that it's better than being out on the street, and that through us they're getting to make other connections with people who are going to be here and be able to keep them plugged in the future.
John, where do you live now?
I live in Echo Park, which is it's a Latino neighborhood, and it's about 10 minutes by car northwest of the Skid Row area. So it's, you know, I don't have, unlike when I was living in New York, East Village, which is my training ground, I guess, for being on Skid Row, when I go home, I don't have to worry. I can walk out the door and I don't have to worry about terrible things happening to me. But when I'm downtown, I think about it.
Do you own much or have much money? And I was wondering if... it must be hard to make a lot of money in the line of work that you're in. But beyond that, I was wondering if you'd feel too kind of self-conscious about it to have much, even if you did?
Well, yeah, you get sucked into the whole guilt thing. I mean, I don't have a lot of money. You know, I don't have to worry about that. But still, if you have a place to stay, then, you know, then everyone I work with thinks I'm, you know, John D. Rockefeller instead of John D. Malpied, you know. So, from their point of view, they think I must have all sorts of money, you know. So it is a difficult situation, and it's difficult to say no to people, you know, when the need is there, but the need is overwhelming, you know, and it's even John D. Rockefeller could not solve all the problems that are out there, you know, nor is just throwing money at it the way to solve it, you know. But I've learned through doing too much, you know, for having too many people living at my house, for giving away too much money that was stupidly given away, stuff like that, that I have to set real limits, you know, on myself, or otherwise, you know, I'm going to go nuts, you know, and jump out the window. And I only live on the first floor, you know, so that's a big problem.
Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
John Malpied and Kevin Williams of the LAPD. The group performs regularly on the streets of Los Angeles. In March, they'll travel to Washington, D.C. to work with homeless people with AIDS. They'll be in Chicago from April 8th through May 20th at the Randolph Street Gallery. And in September, they'll be part of the Los Angeles Festival, directed by Peter Sellers. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer knows. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Terry. We have reports today from Romania. There were demonstrations against the government there over the weekend in Bucharest, and tonight coal miners are arriving from central Romania to demonstrate for the government, so we'll be keeping track of that. We have a profile of Czechoslovakian President Václav Havel from Deborah Amos, and we have a long piece on the rainforest, an interesting experiment in making the rainforest profitable. And for something completely different, Girls' Night Out. It's a nightclub act.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Four years after the space shuttle Challenger exploded, ABC is presenting a TV docudrama about the events leading up to the disaster. It'll be broadcast next Sunday. TV critic David Bianculli has this preview.
First of all, I'm disgusted by the very idea that the Challenger disaster is being made into a TV movie. This docudrama stuff has gotten way out of hand. And no matter how much the networks say they want to do justice to an actual event, there's the unavoidable injustice that these docudramas are produced and presented to sell soap and get big ratings. And there's another problem. Before I watched ABC's Challenger telemovie, I was skeptical that any drama could make me feel as deeply as I did when the Challenger exploded in 1986. There was something about that mission, and particularly the death of teacher Krista McAuliffe, that really hurt. Washington Post TV critic Tom Shales, writing about it the next day, said we all had a teacher like Krista McAuliffe at some point in our lives, and that's why we all felt such a sense of loss. He was exactly right. Well, ABC's Challenger movie doesn't even come close to stirring up those emotions. But at least writer George England has the good taste to stop the movie right after liftoff. In fact, his intentions are almost noble. He wants us to get to know all seven of the astronauts who died that day and to understand the technical concerns and internal politics surrounding the launch itself. He starts the drama with Karen Allen as Krista McAuliffe, conducting a final rehearsal for the lesson plan she intends to broadcast from space to school kids back on Earth.
Hello, I'm Krista McAuliffe, talking to you from the flight deck of the Space Shuttle Challenger. We're in orbit now, and we've just stowed our seats. Let me tell you, being launched into space is every bit as thrilling as they said it would be. When those main engines ignite, and right after them the solid rocket boosters, and you're just hurled upwards, well, it's something unusual in this school teacher's life.
After that scene, the drama shifts backward in time, showing how the astronauts prepared for their ill-fated mission, and how some engineers at Morton Thiokol and NASA were worried about the O-ring seals on the booster rockets. Peter Boyle plays the Morton Thiokol engineer who, in this scene, delivers a lunchroom sermon about the clear and present dangers.
Since Flight 17, we know something we didn't know before. The primary O-ring can fail completely. If that ever happens in one of the major sections of the rocket, it's a jump ball as to whether the joint holds or fails. If it fails, there'll be a catastrophe of the highest order.
The best way to look at this Challenger movie is as a continuation of the film The Right Stuff. Some of director Glenn Jordan's scenes and montages actually deserve that comparison, especially the scene in which Mission Commander Dick Scobie, played by Barry Bostwick, teaches McAuliffe to fly a jet plane. The worst way to look at this Challenger movie is as a space mission disaster film, like a NASA equivalent of the airport or earthquake movies, only without any survivors. And actually, it falls somewhere in between. Bostwick, Boyle, and Lane Smith, who plays a Marshall Flight Center manager, give solid performances, although Karen Allen, as McAuliffe, spends much of the film smiling like Jack Nicholson's Joker. And I question some of the politics and portrayals. Everything seems so clear in hindsight, and everyone seems so noble. And even though this docudrama is much more responsible than reprehensible, I'm still not convinced it had to be made, or ought to be seen.
David Bianculli is TV critic for The New York Post. Today's show is produced by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the state of the theater with theater critic, producer, and director Robert Brustein. Remember the fry cook in the film Chan is Missing, the one who sang Fry Me to the Moon? He was played by Peter Wong. Wong is now a film director, and next time we talk about his new movie, The Laser Man. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.